Now we're holding on Tess Amud Beis at the bottom by the Mishnah. Now that throughout the Perek we've been through, for much of the Perek we've been learning about the dinim of Aina in terms of overcharging or underpaying, and the last Mishnah and the Gemara on it had talked about Ainas Dvarim, about not wronging somebody or hurting their feelings verbally. So now the Perek finishes off with a couple of other business practices, what's usur and what's mutter in terms of cheating the other person, in terms of outright cheating or making something look better than it is or whatever. So the Mishnah starts off, Ein ma'arvin peiros b'peiros. You're not allowed to mix one kind of one fruit with fruit, meaning in other words that you're saying you're talking about a balabais over here. Rashi points out we're talking about a balabais as opposed to, for example, a merchant who obviously is going to buy from many different suppliers. But a balabais, let's say, who's saying to a potential customer, "I'm going to sell you the peiros from such and such a field." So he's not allowed to mix in produce from a different field, because even if they're on the face of it the same quality, the fact is different ones are going to be slightly different. Even if it's new with new, even if it's new with new, needless to say, if he's mixing new ones into old ones, where the old ones are better. Rashi gives an example. If we're talking about grain, for example, old grain is better in the sense that since it's drier, you can get more flour out of it. Now it would come out from the way Rashi is saying it, then that you would be allowed to do the other way around. If you're telling him I'm selling you new grain, then you're allowed to mix in some old grain into it. On the other hand, the Rosh says that not necessarily, because on the customer may be buying it because he wants to keep it for a while. He wants to keep it until it ages, and then in that case, if you're selling him some old mixed into it, then you wouldn't be then he wouldn't be able to do that, because then it would end up spoiling. The Mishnah continues, Be'emes Amru, in truth they said, and we're going to see in the Gemara what that expression means. Be'yayin, when it comes to wine, he tirul arav kosher barach. The Chachamim said you are allowed to mix in a little bit of kosher into rach. Kosher means harsh or strong, and rach means weak. So there's various possibilities. Does kosher and rach mean? Does rach mean a more diluted type of wine, and kosher then would be a more thick, syrupy type of wine? Does it mean that rach means a wine with a lower alcohol content, and kosher means with higher alcohol content? Does it mean rach, a wine that tastes better, and kosher that has a harsher taste, like dry wine? Let's say there's different possibilities. So again, Rashi says, for example, Rashi says that as the Mishnah is going to go on to say, the kosher makes the rach better. So whether we understand that the kosher is more syrupy or has a stronger flavor or whatever, it makes the rach good. So therefore, out of kosher b'rach, when it comes to wine, the Chachamim allow you to mix some kosher into rach because it improves it. The Rosh actually understands that no, the rach is actually better tasting than the kosher and is worth more, but you're allowed to mix in a little kosher because mixing in some kosher, the Rosh learns, makes it that the wine will be preserved for longer, which fits well with the idea maybe of kosher is a higher alcohol content and it keeps it from spoiling faster. Whatever the case, there you're allowed to do that because mashbichoy, because it makes it better. And then Rashi says it has to be that way around. It has to be that way. If you're saying I'm gonna sell you X amount of rach wine, then you're allowed to mix in some kosher wine, but not the other way around, because we're saying the kosher improves the rach and not the other way around. And the same thing as far as chadashim b'yishanim, you're not allowed to mix in chadashim into yishanim, but Rashi says yishanim b'chadashim would be fine. Again, the Rosh disagrees on that last point. And the in fact, Hagoras HaGura points out in addition that the Rif has the Girsa the other way around, that you're not allowed to mix Yeshanim into Chadoshim, but according to him, you might be able to mix Chadoshim into Yeshanim. So different Girsas and different explanations over here. Continues the Mishnah, Ein Ma'arvin Shimre Yayin B'Yayin. You're not allowed. Tosfos, by the way, brings in connection with this Kadoshim and Yeshanim thing. Tosfos points out at the modern Bava Basra that says that in general most things are better when they're aged, except for a few things that are listed over there: dates and beer and hausina, which is a type of gefilte fish. So therefore, in general, all, as Rashi says over here, old grain is going to be better than new grain in the sense that you'll get more flour out of it. And similarly, with most other kinds of produce, old is better than new. The Mishnah continues, "Ein ma'avin shimra yayin b'yayin." You're not allowed to mix the dregs of wine into wine. Avol noisin loyos shmarav, but you can give the person when you're selling him wine, you give him the dregs with it. We're going to see in the Gemara exactly what this means, when you're allowed to, what you're allowed to do with the dregs and what you're not. Another din, mishnas out of mayim b'yayin. A person who had water mixed into his wine, loyim korena b'chanus, he should not sell that wine in the store where they buy wine. Now a chanus is a store, but specifically it means the kind of place where people buy wine in small quantities to drink shortly thereafter, as opposed to, in other words, you could sell wine wholesale, where people buy an entire barrel and buy it for resale or whatever. But here we're talking about that you're not allowed to sell it in a chanus, where people are going to be buying wine a little bit at a time, because people are going to think that it's completely wine and it's not, there's water in it. Unless you inform the storekeeper unless you inform each customer who comes that you should know there's water mixed in over here, so that they know to discount it by the appropriate amount, and they know that they're not getting all wine. Below the tagger, and as far as this wine mixed with water, you wouldn't be able to sell it to a merchant who's going to sell it wholesale, who's going to sell the entire barrel to somebody else. Even though you inform him, because he himself is only going to use it for cheating other people. He himself is not necessarily going to tell his customers that there's wine in it. He's going to sell the whole barrel as is and claim that it's all wine, and then the customer eventually is going to discover there's water in it, and you can't do that. On the other hand, in a place where they regularly put water into wine, then they can do that, because then it's a known thing. Wines in such places have a chazakah that they contain water. So therefore, that's the expected thing. You have, for example, many wines nowadays are like that. Actually, many wines nowadays actually when the wineries bottle and sell them, they make them from concentrate, and they put in a certain amount of water, and that's expected. And therefore, there's nothing dishonest about that. The Mishnah continues, "Hatagur noto mehegronis." Now, before we were talking about as far as not mixing peiros, old with new, or new with old, or whatever. So we were talking about a balabayas who is telling the customer that I'm selling you peiros from such and such a field, so he can't mix in peiros from other fields. But now, hatagur, when it comes to a merchant who regularly buys things and then sells them in bulk, he can take, for example, from five different granaries, five different threshing floors, five different people who sold them their grain, and put it all into one bin and sell it indiscriminately, because everybody knows that a tagger buys from lots of different people. So he can buy from five different wine presses, and he puts it all into one barrel. Same idea there. You don't have the issues of kosher and rach that we said before, because everybody knows that a tagger buys from many different people and sells. As long as he doesn't mean to mix it, in other words, he shouldn't be putting out, for example, he shouldn't be advertising that he's selling selling grain from such and such a place, which is known to be good, or wine from such and such a place, which is known to be good, and then mix in inferior stuff. So like this, if he advertises, I'm selling wine in general, or I'm selling grain in general, then good, but otherwise not. Okay. The Gemara starts off, Tonon Abanon. When we talked about in the beginning of the Mishnah about the Chadoshim and Yeshanim, when it comes to grain or other kinds of peiros. So the Gemara says, "Tanan Rabbanan, Ein Tzarich Lomer Chadoshes Me'arav Yeshonis Mishalosh." Needless to say that if the new grain is selling at the rate of 4 sa per sela, the Yeshonis Mishalosh, and the old grain is selling at 3 per sela, meaning that the old grain is worth more than the old, the Ein Ma'arvin. That's what that would be when the Mishnah is saying you can't mix in new, because here you see you're telling a person, I'm selling you old grain, which not only is better quality, but in fact right now is worth more because it's selling for 3 sa to the sela, as opposed to the new, which is selling for 4. Saw to the seller. So needless to say, in Ma'arvin, you wouldn't be allowed to mix in new grain into the old, because then not only you're making it, not only you're reducing the quality, because the old, as we said, is better quality than the new, but also you're cheating him on the price, because the, like this, if you sold him all old grain, the new grain is worth less, so you're charging him more, and you're giving him a product which is actually worth less in the market. Ela filu chadoshes mishalosh v'yishonis me'arba. Even if the new grain is selling at 3 sa to the seller and the old grain at 4 sa to the seller, so meaning in other words that the old grain is selling at a cheaper price, ein ma'arvin, you're still not allowed to mix in new grain into the old. You could say I'm giving him something that's worth more on the current market. No, neshadim reitz liyachnon, because he may want to keep it around to age it. The reason is, it actually explains, why would it be right now that new grain is worth more than the old, considering that the old is better quality? It must be because right now people want to save it and people want to age it. So now, when a person comes and says, I want to buy aged grain, that means he doesn't want to do like everybody else is doing and store it away for later. He wants to be able to use it shortly after. So therefore, you can't mix in chadoshes, because again, chadoshes is going to produce less less flour than old, and therefore you're defrauding him. Okay. Then we said in the Mishnah, be'emes amru, in truth they said, be'yayin yitidol out of kosher barach. When it comes to wine, they allow you to mix some kosher, some whatever kosher means, whether it means syrupy or stronger tasting or more alcoholic or whatever, berach into rach, which would be the opposite of that, because it improves it. So Omer of Elazar, Ada Omra, from this, this tells us, the fact that the Mishnah says over here on this Be'emes Omru, Since the Mishnah is giving us a very clear and logical reason for this halacha, because it improves it, and there's no second guessing that. So objectively, it's true that kosher improves rach. Mixing in a little kosher into rach improves it. So the fact that the Mishnah is telling us like that and is introducing such a straightforward halacha, such a logical halacha with the words be'emes amru, that tells us, Rabbi Elazar says, kol be'emes amru halacha. Whatever it says be'emes amru means this is the halacha, and there's no arguing on it or anything. So don't start second guessing or arguing on it, because the Mishnah is giving you a clear reason. And the same way, any place else in Shas where it says Be'emes Amru, says Rav Elazar, you learn from this that it means that's how it is, and that's that. In fact, there are Mephoshim who learn that the word is not just halacha, but halacha l'moshe misina. So in fact, the Rambam, when the Rambam lists the various known halachos l'moshe misina, he lists this among them. And that means, in other words, that Rabbi Elazar is saying not just that this is a halacha that everybody should know and accept and there's no arguing. It's actually a halacha l'moshe misinai, and because of that, there's no arguing on it. With that said, various achronim discuss the possibilities. There are places where the Gemara says be'emes amru, on the Yerushalmi actually says it that way, that the Rabbi Elazar says that whenever it says be'emes, it means halacha l'moshe misinai. And in fact, again, the Rambam does list it in his list of halachos l'moshe misinai. Different achronim talk about different possibilities. The fact is that there are halachos elsewhere in Shas that are introduced with be'emes amru and are clearly dirabonans. In Masechta Shabbos, for example, you have the din about not reading on Shabbos by candlelight because you may adjust the wick. And then the Mishnah mentions in that connection a detail in that that's be'emes omru, and the whole concept of not reading on Shabbos by candlelight is a gzeira d'rabbanan. So I said different achronim talk about the Maharat Chayas, and others talk about that that maybe in fact when we say halacha l'moshe m'sinai and these things, we don't mean literally halacha l'moshe m'sinai. We just mean a halacha that is so well accepted that it's as if it was halacha l'moshe m'sinai, that everybody agrees to it and nobody ever has ever said otherwise. Okay. However, Rav Nachman says the din of our Mishnah only applies during the time of the wine pressing. So then what happens is during that time, when the wine is being pressed and fermenting in the barrels, then at that point, if you put one type of wine, if you mix rach wine together, if you mix kosher wine into rach, so then they ferment together, and therefore it becomes a nice blended flavor. But after, as opposed to, in other words, after the time of the wine pressing, then each type of wine already has its own flavor, and therefore to mix it is not going to improve things. It's going to do the opposite. The Ravid says it slightly differently. He says that at the time of the wine pressing, all wine is sweet. So now you're mixing in some kosher. So therefore, that helps it for the future as well. But the rest of the time, it's going to improve it, but only for a short time. Meanwhile, what's going to happen? You're selling it as good wine now, but then shortly afterwards, it's going to deteriorate, and therefore you've sold them an inferior product. So the Gemara says, "Va'idnuk dekama avi shaloi ben agitis." What about nowadays? The Gemara is saying later in the times of the Amoraim, where they do in fact mix it, even shaloi ben agitis, even not during the time of the wine pressing. How is that allowed? Amar Papa diyadi v'komachli. So the Papa says because people know that that's the common practice, and therefore they're moichal. Rav Acha Breder of Ika says a different answer. You don't have to say that people know about it and they're mortal. Maybe not everybody knows about it, but Homani Rav Acha, but our Mishnah would go like Rav Acha, the Tani, Rav Acha Mate V'Dava HaMitam. Rav Acha does allow mixing when it's something that you can easily taste. Here, what you can do is you can actually taste the wine. In general, in those days, when you bought wine, you would first be allowed to taste it first to check the flavor and the quality and whatever. So when the customer tastes it, he's going to be able to detect that, hey, we have over here what used to be rach wine and has a little bit of kosher mixed in. He'll be able to notice the difference, and therefore that's allowed, because at that point he'll know what he's getting, and then he can decide whether to buy it or not. So in other words, according to that answer, it doesn't require us to say that everybody knows that this is how it's done. Even if somebody doesn't know, as soon as he tastes it, as soon as he taste tests it, he's going to find out. And Rav Acha says such things are allowed. Okay, we said in the Mishnah, the Ein Ma'arvin Shimre Yayin B'Yayin. Now we said you're not allowed to mix in the dregs of wine with the wine, but you're allowed to give the person, when you're selling him the wine, you give him the dregs with it. So the Gemara says, What do you mean? The Resha says that you're not allowed to mix in dregs at all. So what are we saying now that you're allowed to give him the dregs? So you're going to say that maybe when the Mishnah says he's giving him the dregs, means that he's informing him, you should know the wine I'm selling you is not perfectly clear wine. It's got dregs at the bottom of it. And you're going to say that's what the Mishnah means, and that's allowed. But no, because since in the next part of the Mishnah about water mixed into the wine, it says where it says there that you can't sell it retail in a store unless you inform each customer that there's wine mixed in below the tag of idea. And as far as the wine that has water mixed in, you're not allowed to sell it to a merchant who's going to resell it to others in bulk, even if you inform him, because he's going to use it to cheat other people. Now there it talks about informing people, about informing the customers, or when that even that doesn't help. Implying that earlier in the Mishnah, we're not talking about informing or anything, and nevertheless, the Mishnah is saying that no sin lo yishmaro. So what's the case? Are you allowed to give him wine with dregs, or are you not? So Rabbi Yehuda says this is what it means. It means when you have, let's say, a batch of wine from yesterday or from today, Meaning two different batches, two different barrels of wine. And Rashi says we don't necessarily mean literally today or yesterday. We're using that as an example to mean different barrel to mean different barrels of wine. So Tosfos explains that in the Havamina of the Gemara, when it thought that it meant kamoi delay, that he's informing him, Tosfos explains that you would think that maybe it would still be also to mix in other dregs so he doesn't cheat other people with it. But now we're saying it's not a matter of informing or not. It means it's a matter of which barrel are we talking about. In ma'arid shmoim shal emesh b'shal yoyim, you can't mix in dregs of yesterday's wine into today's wine. And again, it doesn't have to mean yesterday and today. It just means two different barrels of wine. Or of today's into yesterday's, either way, to take dregs from one barrel and transfer them to the other, that'll ruin the quality of the wine. But you can give the person, when you're selling the person the barrel, you can have included in it the dregs that come with that barrel. You're allowed to do that. There's no problem with that because that doesn't ruin the wine. Tanya Nami Hochi. In fact, we learn like that in the Braisa. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a shofa yayin machaber, right? Rabbi Yehuda says that if a person is shofa wine to somebody else. Now Rashi explains that shofa means when you pour off gently, like this, when you're selling wine, typically what you would do is you don't usually sell him the wine with the barrel. A lot of times what you'll do is you'll pour the wine into his container. So you can have when you're pouring it just all at once, you're just like dumping it in, and everything that was in the original barrel goes into the new one as much as possible. Then you have a shofa, which is where you're pouring it off gently in order to avoid getting dregs in there. So here, a shofa yayin l'chaver, he's pouring wine gently for the other person. So you can't mix in yesterday's dregs into today's wine or today's wine with or today's dregs with yesterday's wine. And again, Rashi says we don't literally mean today's and yesterday's. We just mean two different batches, two different barrels of wine. You're not allowed to do that because here he was shofet to begin with. He was pouring it off gently to avoid the dregs. He can't add the dregs in afterwards. But he can mix in the dregs of today's wine with today's or yesterday's with yesterday's. And that's fine because again, it came from this very same barrel, and therefore it's not gonna have a bad effect. Earlier, actually, on Daf Mem, there was a whole discussion on the question of whether you're allowed to mix in dregs into wine anyway. There was a whole sugya on that. But one way of looking at it is there actually it was talking about not in connection with wine, but in connection with oil, which also has dregs. When you're selling somebody oil. At a time when the oil is expected to be clear because all the dregs have sunk to the bottom, would you be allowed to go and remix them up in order to sell them? And that way you're gaining because that way you're not having to give them a full amount of pure oil. You're allowed to have some of it is going to be dregs. And the Gemara had a whole discussion about that between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda, whether you would be allowed to or not. But here we're talking about wine, so it's a similar point. Then Rabbi Yehuda is saying, and our Mishnah is saying, you are allowed to you can give him the dregs together with the wine, but maybe the difference might be with oil dregs. There's not really much that you can do with them. With wine dregs, we find in many places in Shas, what you could do is you could make a liquid called temed out of it, which is that you would take those dregs of wine. You'd pour some water over them, and after a while, the water would absorb the color and the flavor of the wine that's left in the dregs, and then you have a kind of dilute wine Maybe the point is with oil, you couldn't really do that. So that's what it means. So that's what the Mishnah means when it says that you can't mix the dregs of wine with wine, but you can give him his dregs, meaning, in other words, that you can give the you can put the dregs of this particular barrel of wine in with the wine when you're selling it, but not mix in from a different barrel. Okay, the Mishnah had said Mishnas Arab Mayim B'Yeinu, that if water was mixed into somebody's wine, then you can't sell it retail in a store where people buy it in small quantities, unless you inform every customer. And then we said you can't sell it to a merchant even if you inform him because he's going to use it to cheat other people. So the Gemara tells a case. Rava was one time brought wine from such a store where they sell wine retail. Mazde, he mixed it with water because that's usually how you do when they wouldn't drink wine neat back then. They would mix it with water first. So he did that. Tame, he tasted it. Lo habobosim, it didn't taste so good. Shadwe lachanuso, so he sent it back to the store for a refund. So Abaye says, how could you do that? Doesn't the Mishnah say that you can't sell this is yeah, that you can't sell the wine and you can't sell the wine to a with water mixed in to a merchant, even though you inform him? And here, in other words, that this storekeeper, Rashi explains, is like a tagger over you. He's gonna go and sell it to other people. You see, in other words, he didn't inform you to begin with that it doesn't taste good. The same way he's not gonna inform potential customers that it has wine, that it has water in it, and then he's gonna sell it to and then claim that it's all wine. So Rava says the difference is mizgadidi, my kind of mixing in water is very noticeable. Because Rava would put in more wine, or would put in more water than most people would. Tosfos has some discussion about it. It seems from other Gemaras that Rava would regularly dilute his wine with 3 parts water, whereas everybody else would do with 2 parts water. And Tosfos discusses in some detail over here is that the 2 versus 3 parts are the different kinds of wine in that regard as far as how much you would dilute them. Tosfos, by the way, mentions an interesting point in this connection. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that when you have the Sanhedrin Gdola of 71 members, not all of them have to be present at all times. As long as you have a minimum number of quorum, then other ones are allowed to leave to do other things. And in particular, the Gemara says you can't have less than one third. You can't have more than 2/3 of them leave. You can have 23 of them left. 23 out of 71 is 1/3. And the Gemara derives that from a pasuk in Shir HaShirim that mentions diluted wine. So that implies that the regular amount for dilution is 1 in 3, 1 part wine to 2 parts water. And so Tosfos discusses the ins and outs of that in terms of this point over here of exactly how much the expected dilution is, where there are other Gemaras that imply that it should be one to three, 1 part wine to 3 parts water. And then Tosfos brings an interesting idea that it means also that the word mozeg over there, it may not mean dilute. I mean, it does mean dilution of wine, but we may be doubting not from the meaning of the word as dilution, but rather from the gematria of it. The gematria of mozeg is 50. Mem zayin gimel is 50. So it means you can't have 50 members leave, but you can have 49 members leave. That'll leave you with 22. And then, since anyway you can't have a base din of an even number, then anyway they're going to have to promote somebody to be the 23rd. So we can douche in it that way, and therefore it has nothing to do directly with the mixing of wine. In any case, our Gemara is saying that Rava is saying that his way of mixing water is very obvious. People can recognize that there's a people can easily recognize that there's a lot of wine, that there's a lot of water in there. The Gemara in Masechta Nedarim also tells a story involving Rava mixing a cup of wine for Rabbi Yosef, and as soon as Rabbi Yosef tastes it, he knows that this must have been mixed by Rava. So he says to Abaya, when you have a regular person puts some water, when you have a person puts a little amount of water into their wine, that's when the Mishnah is saying that you can't sell it that you have to inform everybody, etc. But when you have so much water in it, as I usually do, that will be very obvious, then it's not a problem. The Chitema and Rava continues, you're going to worry about the Tofi Umachayle. You're going to think that maybe what the storekeeper is going to do is going to mix in some more wine, and then he's going to and then sweeten it, and then he's going to claim that and then he's going to claim that it's all wine. In other words, what is he going to do? He's going to take this wine, for example, that I sent back to him for a refund, which is now 3/4 water and 1/4 wine. Let's say he's going to go mix in some wine until the water is only. Is only 2/3 or a half or whatever, and then it won't be as noticeable, and then he's going to cheat the customers with that. Rava says, and then he's going to sell it, claiming that it's all wine. You don't have to worry about that. In Canaan, Ladrava, so if you're going to worry about that, there's no end to the matter, because by the same token, you wouldn't be allowed to sell to the storekeeper plain water because he might mix it in wine. So no, you're only also to sell him something that he can use as is to cheat people, not something where he himself would then have to go mix it with something else. So therefore, Rava says it's fine in that kind of case to send back the wine for a refund. Okay. The Mishnah had finished off Makom Shenagol Lahato Mayim B'Yayin Natilu B'Cholav, that in places where they customarily add wine, add water to wine, then you're allowed to do that because everybody knows that's how it's done. Tana, we learn it fuller. Tana, we learn it a price. L'mechza l'shlish v'l'reviyah. That could be, for example, there are different places. In some places, they would mix in half the they would mix in half the total amount would end up being half water and half wine. In other places, a third. In other places, a quarter. Whatever the minhag hamidin is. And like we had before, Rav says this is only talking about during the time of the wine pressing. That's when customarily people add water to the wine. After that, it would be also to do that because then it ruins the wine. The Mishnah had said. So that's that. So that covers various halachas as far as mixing in, as far as mixing grain or wine or whatever. Now the Mishnah continues with other kinds of practice, with other kinds of business practices that might put other people at a disadvantage. The Mishnah says, Rabbi Yehuda oimba lo yechalaka chenveni kloyus ve'agozim tinoyus. Rabbi Yehuda says that a storekeeper is not allowed to give out chloyus, which are toasted grain, which has a sweet taste, ve'agozim, or nuts, the tinoyus to children. So in other words, you might have, you have sometimes in some stores, like you have a candy dish where the kids can take a candy or whatever, and that encourages them to go shop at that store more often. So you can't, if they show about good and loving it, Rabbi Yehuda says you can't do that because exactly that, then you're, that's going to be accustoming the kids to go by him, and it's going to put everybody else at a disadvantage. The Chacham Matirin and the Chacham say mutter, as we're going to learn in the Gemara, because the Chachamim say the storekeeper can say to the other ones, listen, you guys put out candies as well. You guys can also attract the kids with the same kind of treats that were even better treats than I am. So I'm not putting you at a disadvantage. It just means that you can do the same kind of thing. Continues the Mishnah. The storekeeper, one storekeeper, is not allowed to go and reduce prices on his own. Because again, that causes, that takes away customers from other people. The Chum say not only he can do that, but he's remembered for good, as we're going to see in the Gemara. Now you do have in modern societies, you have a concept called predatory pricing. Sometimes you have somebody who has such a strong hold on the market that he can undersell anybody else. He can afford to take a loss on certain things, and eventually he'll drive them out of business. So now the Oruch HaShochan actually deals with that point. When he deals with these halachas, he points out, the Gemara is going to explain that he's allowed to be zachol latov because you have people who regularly hoard grain in order to, that then the price should go up and they're going to be able to sell it for more. Now when he's lowering the prices, then it causes those kinds of hoarders and speculators to be able to say, you know what, we're not going to get anywhere with that. We may as well put our grain on the market, and that'll make things easier for everybody else. So the Oruch HaShochan, in fact, says that this whole din would only apply to things like grain or things like that can regularly be hoarded. He says other kinds of things you wouldn't be allowed to do that because then you're ruining everybody else's livelihood. You're cutting into their profit margins. And obviously when he's doing it for predatory reasons in order to drive everybody out of business, then also that such a thing would be awesome. But here we're talking about where there's nothing of that. He has no hope of either. He's not a big enough merchant compared to them to do anything like that. He's just lowering the prices, and therefore, as the Gemara is going to say, that makes it. But now all the speculators and the hoarders are going to say, forget about it. We're not going to get anywhere with that. Let's put our grain or whatever it is on the market, and that'll make it easier for everybody else. There'll be more supply for everybody else, and therefore people will be able to buy more easily. Continues the Mishnah. Lo yovers agrisin divrei Abishol. Abishol says that you're not allowed to pick out the psoilus from beans. Grisin are actually split peas. You're selling split peas, and typically they come with some psoilus mixed in with them, whether we're talking about pieces of shells, whether we're talking about dirt, whatever it is. So now what happens is, now normally you're going to sell them and there's going to be some dirt or whatever, or waste or whatever mixed in with them. And usually people understand that and people accept that. When I buy grisin, I know there's going to be a certain amount of that in. Now Abishol is saying that you're not allowed to go and pick out the psoilus to sell it completely clean. The reason is because then you're doing the customers a favor, it is true, but you're going to charge them a lot more for it, much more than the amount of improvement that you made to them. So in other words, in other words, you could say the improvement in value is now that instead of being worth $5 a pound, let's say now they're worth $7 a pound because now they're completely clean. Without that, the person is when he buys, let's say a pound's worth, he's only getting, let's say, 80% is grisin and the rest was going to be soilless. Now you're taking that out, therefore you're raising the price. But the problem is you're not just going to raise the price to $7. You're going to want to raise the price to more, to $8 or $9 or $10 or whatever. And therefore you're overcharging for more than the improvement you put into it. Therefore, Abba Shaul says you shouldn't do that. The Chum Now the Chum do agree with Abba Shaul, that he's not allowed to only pick out the psoilus from the top of the bin, meaning, in other words, that he's gonna go do this with the top layer, and then he's gonna do this only with the top layer, and pretend like the whole rest of it is also picked out like that. And later on, a customer is gonna buy it, and he's gonna find that later on there is psoilus in it. And in fact, the Ben Yehoyada points out over here, the point is, even the guy is going to have bought it, he's going to find later on, you know what, I expected it was clean. It turns out there's soilus in it, but you know what, I'm not going to bother. I'm not going to bother. I'm too embarrassed to return it or whatever. So the Chum agree, you can't do that in the first place. And that's just stealing people's eyes, meaning that's just misleading people. They see the top layer is completely clean. They're going to think the whole thing is clean, and they're going to buy it on that basis. And then later on, they discover that it's not so. The Mishnah finishes off. Ein mefarkasin, you're not allowed to beautify. Lo yasa odam, not a person. For example, an eved knani who's going to be sold. Lo yasa behema, or animals. Lo yasa kelim, or kelim. All of the beautiful. We'll see in the Gemara what we mean by beautifying them. But basically, the idea is to make something old. To make something old look like it was new, you're not allowed to do that. So, an example nowadays, let's say you're selling a used car and you put a new coat of paint on it. So that you're not allowed to do. On the other hand, as we're going to learn in the Gemara, you are allowed to improve the appearance of, you are allowed to touch up the appearance of new things to make them look nicer. That you're allowed to do because they're new anyway. Actually, the Moshe has a tshuva on this where he discusses that even with old things, you might be allowed to touch them up a little bit so they don't look completely old. You can't make them look new, as the Mishnah is saying, but you would be allowed to, like maybe remove some of the obvious scuff marks or whatever to at least make it look not quite so used and worn. So the Gemara says in the first case of the Mishnah, when we're talking about giving nuts and things like that to the kid, the nuts and toasted grain to the kids, why is Rabbi Yehuda? So Rabbi Yehuda is saying it's not allowed because you're putting the other storekeeper at a disadvantage. Why do the Chachamim allow it? My time I did Rabbanon. And the reason is to Amalei, because the one storekeeper can say to the other ones, "Anoma fligna amguzi, look, I'm giving out nuts, va'at polig shisti. You give out plums, and you can also attract kids to your store that way. So therefore, I'm not putting you at a disadvantage." The Mishnah had said, "Below yifches is a shahar. A storekeeper is not allowed to unilaterally lower his prices." And the Chum say such a person should be remembered for good. So my time at the Rabbanon, why the Chacham say zocher latoy? Why don't they just say? Why are they giving them bracha to say that mutter? And the reason is mishum to come marvach latara, because he makes that prices are now going to go down in general. Because like we said, the hoarders now, the ones who are speculating in produce, who are till now have been hoarding it, and the Gemara elsewhere, and Baba Basra in particular, talks very negatively about those oitzrei peiros, those hoarders who speculate in it and hold on to it until prices rise, and they put the poor people at a terrible disadvantage. So like this, when he's lowering the prices, that causes that everybody else is going to lower their prices as well, and therefore the speculators realize we're not going to get anywhere with hoarding it, and we might as well go and sell our grain now, and therefore it makes it easier for everybody else. So that's why they say tovei ala bracha. Okay, we said in the mission of la yovaras agrisin divrei Abba Shaul had said you're not allowed to pick out the psoilus from among the split beans. So man chachamim Rav Acha, who was the chachamim of our Mishnah, is specifically Rav Acha. Tanya, we learn in a braisa, Rav Acha matir b'davar hanira. Rav Acha allows it when it's something visible. The The same way as we learned on Amud Aleph, we said Rav Acha allows when it's something that you can taste and you can easily see that you can easily taste the difference for yourself. The same way Rav Acha says over here, you can easily see the difference for yourself between clean, between beans that are cleaned out where there's no psoilus mixed in with them, versus ones that have psoilus in it. The customer himself can see the difference, and he himself can decide whether it's worth it to pay that the extra amount for that. So there's no cheating the customer and involved, even if you are charging a higher price than objectively it should be worth. Okay. The Mishnah said, "Ain mefarkasin la'isa adam v'cholav la'isa kelim." You're not allowed to beautify a person of an eved who's being offered for sale, or behema or kelim. So the Gemara gives some examples. Tana rabbanan, ain meshavetin es behema. You're not allowed to mesharvet an animal, and the Gemara is going to give the word mesharvetin is related to the word sharvet, like you have by Esther and Achashverosh, just sharvet hazav. So it means a stick or staff. But the Gemara is going to give in a second two explanations of what mesharvetin means. The en noifchin bakravayim. You're not allowed to blow up kishkis if you're selling kishkis by themselves. So you want to blow them up so they'll look bigger. You're not allowed to do that. The insurance is a boss of a mayim, and you're not allowed to soak meat in water, where the point is that then what happens is that that causes that bleaches the meat a little bit, that makes it look lighter color than it otherwise would. And therefore, in particular, the potential customer is going to think that it's fattier than it otherwise is, and that's going to be cheating him because it's not. So there, when it comes to the soaking in water, there also you have that the smear points out that where around on Shulchan Aruch, that where people regularly do it, then it would be more to, like we had other cases like that before. On the other hand, the Alter Rebbe, when he brings this in Shulchan Aruch, he says maybe what the smear is saying is true technically, but still Shomer Nafshe Yirchak Mizeh, a person who's careful with the neshama shouldn't do that, because still the customer is going to think that it really is fat, because after all, there are a lot of different degrees of fatness in the world. So, and in fact, you're saying that everybody does it. The reason everybody does it is because they're trying to cheat the customers. The Alter Rebbe says, even though everybody does it, it's not really an excuse. In other words, the Alter Rebbe would agree, obviously, with the things that we said on Amud Aleph, where everybody does it. That's different because everybody knows what they're getting. Here, the fact is, when you're soaking meat in water, it's not so obvious what you're getting, because you may think, okay, it doesn't mean that it has such a percentage of fat, but you're still going to think that it has some other percentage. My ein mesharvetin, when we say ein mesharvetin, that you're not allowed to do a sharvet on the animal, what does that mean? Here in Bavel, they explain it means Maya de Chizra. It means that you give the animal water to drink that has bran in it. And the result is that causes it to bloat. And therefore, therefore that causes it to bloat, so it looks bigger. And it makes its hair stand on end, so it also looks bigger. So therefore, the customer thinks that he's getting a bigger animal than he really is. Ze'iri, I'm a Rav Kahana. Ze'iri explains in the name of Rav Kahana, a different explanation, Maz Kafta. It means when you're brushing the animal's fur, the animal's hair, and make it stick up. So even though you haven't fed it something that makes it bloat, but nevertheless, just the combing its hair to make the hair stand on end itself makes the animal look bigger, and that would be included in the same mishnah. Now, the Gemara gives some examples to the contrary. Shmuel allowed people to put fringes, to put silk fringes on a garment. So you had somebody was selling a garment, and Shmuel allowed him to put fringes on the end of it to make it look nicer. The Ravid, so Rashi explains that in general, Tumi means fringes. The Ravid explains in a little more detail that it means like you take you have on the ends of a talus, where you take several of the fringes and tie them together. And it makes it that this way the end of the cloth doesn't unravel, but it also makes it look nicer. So Shmuel allowed that. Rav Yehuda Sharla Kaskosi Karmi. Rav Yehuda allowed somebody who was selling karmi, which are colorful clothing with designs on it. He allowed him to starch it. He allowed him to starch it again using water with bran mixed in order that it would look nicer. Rabba Shara Lameda Tsari. Rabba, where there was a person who was selling, who was selling clothes made out of canvas, which is hemp or some related or some related species. So he allowed him to pound it with wooden mallets in order that the threads should look finer and better quality. Rava Shadal Talumi Giri. Rava allowed somebody to paint arrows, so that could mean the actual arrows themselves, paint designs on them, or it could mean to paint arrow-shaped designs on clothing or something. Rapapa Bashmul Shadal Talumi Dikuli, and Rapapa Bashmul allowed somebody who was selling baskets to paint designs on those. So the Gemara asks, how is all that allowed? Doesn't the Mishnah say you're not allowed to do these things? And the answer is like Kasha, Hobati. The difference is that all these cases with Shmuel and Rabbi Yehuda and so on and so forth is all where people are selling new things. So they're already new and good on their own. So you just want to add a decoration to them, that's fine. Whereas the Mishnah is talking about old ones, because then it's going to Versailles and it's cheating people. People are going to think it's new because of those features, and really it's not. Okay. The Gemara says, "Pirkus to Adam Ma'i." What do we mean when we talk about beautifying a person? What's an example of that that wouldn't be allowed? So the Gemara says, and b'chla, what good? The Gemara may also be asking, what good would beautifying a person do anyway? If you're buying an Eved, you're not buying him for his looks. You're buying him to do work for you. So what's the Pirkus? So the Gemara gives an example. Kihodahu Avdasav. There was this case of an old Eved. Rashi learns that it was an Eved Knabi, because Rashi points out it was after this story happened, long after the Churban, and Eved Ivri exists only during the time when Yovel is in effect, which went out of effect even during the time when towards the end of the first Beis Mikdash. They weren't able to, because some of the Shvatim had already been taken into Golos. Okay, they had one last Yovel before the Golos. But anyway, so Rashi points out it can't be an Eved Ivri over here. It has to be an Eved Knabi. On the other hand, the Ritva asks on that here the Gemara is going to say that Rava didn't want to buy him. Why not? What's wrong with buying? What's wrong with buying? And at the end of the story, we're going to see, because he's old, Rapapa Bar Shmuel can't have him work for him. So what? He's old. You're allowed to have an Eved Knani work for you, no matter what age he is. And then there's other question as well. So the Ritva and the Rashba explain that the guy was a regular goy, not an Eved Knani. And then the Ravid learns that it was actually a Yid. He wasn't an Eved Ivri. It just means he wanted to hire himself out for a period of time. Okay. Anyway, so this person, so he wanted to get a job. He went and dyed his hair. His hair was already white. So he went and dyed his hair and his beard so that he dyed them black so he'd look young. So he came to Rava. He says to Rava, buy me. So again, whether we're talking about that he was an Eved Knani and now he wants Rava to buy him, whether we're talking about that he was a regular Goy and he wants Rava to buy him as a slave, or whether we're talking about, as the Ravid says, that he was a Yid and he wanted Rava to hire him. Amalei, so Rava says, no. As the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Yiyu Aniyim Bnei Beischa. Poor Jews should be members of your household. In other words, if I need people around my house to work for me, rather than buying an Eved, I'd rather have a Yid work for me and give a Yid parnasa. Now, according to the Ravid, if this guy was a Yid, then the point would be, Maharam Shif says that he wasn't as poor as some of the Rav already had Jews working for him, or he could have worked for him, and he's telling him, you don't quite meet that threshold yet. Go get a different job. You're not so poor that I should that I that that this that this din of the Mishnah applies to you yet. Also, he went to the Papa Bashmul Zabne, and the Papa bought him. The Papa didn't pay attention to that Mishnah in Ovis. Maybe he figured it's only Milu de Chassidus or whatever, and therefore he bought the guy or hired him, as the case may be. Yoimachad Omalei Ashki and Maya. One day, the Papa Bashmul tells this guy, give me a drink of water. And keep in mind, back then, a drink of water didn't just mean you go over to the faucet and turn on the water. It would mean you'd have to go and draw water from the well or the river or whatever and schlep it. So it was a big schlep, and the guy didn't want to do that. Also, chabre l'resho digne. So the guy went and washed out the dye from his hair and beard and now looked old again. Omalei, he says to the Papa Bashmul, chazita, I'm not koshish ma'avuch. Look, I'm older than your father. It's not derech eretz dik that you should be using me as a slave to do work for you like that. So now the Papa Bar Shmuel realized that he had been had. Marsha points out, you know, we learned in Kiddushin, you have that it mentioned over there that Rabbi Yochanan would stand up out of respect for old people, even old goyim. So now this guy is saying in a similar vein to the Papa Bar Shmuel, look, considering how old I am, it wouldn't be derech eretz for you to be using me for such a menial job. So the Papa Bar Shmuel realized that he'd been had. Kori Anafshe, he applied to himself a pasuk. Tzaddik mitzora nechlatz, the tzaddik is saved from a tzara by yovei acher tachtav, and a different person comes in instead of him. In other words, he's saying, Rava acted as a tzaddik, he acted according to Pirkei Avos, and therefore he was saved by being deceived by this guy. Me, I didn't pay attention to that, and therefore I come in instead. The actual Lashon HaPasuk is by Yovel Rosha Achta, but Rav Papa Bar Shmuel doesn't want to call himself a Rosha, so therefore he changes the word Rosha to Acher, that I came in instead of him by doing this, by not paying attention to that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Ben Yehoyada says, on the other hand, Rav Papa Bar Shmuel is also saying, on the other hand, he's saying a positive thing. Listen, you know, I've come out not so good from this, but the fact is, on the other hand, that this may well be, there may have been a greater sorrow waiting for me from the Eivishter, and now I was saved from that because of this, so therefore I'm happy that Hashem put me in this situation, because it may save me from something worse that Hashem had planned for me, and like this, I get away with only this. Hadron Allah Chazal. The next parak, Ezo Neshech, begins talking about the dinim of ribis. Now, in Torah, you basically have ribis is only when you, there's different opinions exactly among the Rishonim, but basically in Torah, ribis is only going to be an issue only when it's, first of all, when there's a loan, not when there's any other kind of transaction, and only when, and primarily only when it was decided at the time of the loan. For example, I'm lending you 100 and I expect you to pay me back with 10% interest. And it could be a loan of money, or it could be a loan of payers, or things like that. So those kinds of things are ribis min haTorah. The Chachamim added many other kinds of ribis because the Torah is so stringent about ribis. Ad kedekach, we're going to learn at the end of the parak that a person who lends at ribis is over on as many as six averus. And because ribis is something very popular and very something people want it because they want to be able to increase their money. So therefore, the Chachamim put a bunch of siyogim around it and made the subject of our parak is going to be then all the dinim of ribis, daraisa, and derabanan. And we're going to see that there's many, many cases that would be completely mutum in Atorah, but the Chachamim answered them because there's a problem, because they're too similar to ribis min Atorah. The basic rule that we're going to have throughout the parak is called wherever there's agar neter, wherever there's, you're giving a person a reward, you're giving him extra because he's waiting to be paid back, then that's included in the dinim of ribis. So the classic ribis min haTorah is exactly that. I'm waiting 6 months or a year or whatever it is to be paid back. Therefore, I want you to pay me extra. I want you to pay me interest. That's how banks work, after all, for example. So now, anything where there's agar neter, and that includes, for example, it includes things like selling, and in some cases, selling on credit. It includes, for example, making a contract in advance about that you're going to sell me X amount of payers. It includes all kinds of, it includes certain kinds of mortgages, etc. All those things are going to be discussed in this parak about the dinim of ribis apply to them and what's allowed and what's not allowed. One thing is the idea behind it that Amban explained. So there are actually Mephoshim who learn that basically that ribis is similar to gezel. In fact, the Gemara is going to ask. The Gemara asks at one point, once the Torah tells us you're not allowed to steal, shouldn't that automatically include ribis? And the Gemara has to find a reason why ribis has to be given as a separate mitzvah. But the Ramban explains it's not really. It has nothing to do with gezel. Otherwise, you wouldn't be allowed to charge ribis to a goy. So he explained, after all, you're not allowed to steal from a goy, as we learned in Baba Kama. So he says, no, what it is that the Torah says when you're lending to a fellow Yid, you have to treat him like a brother. Your brother, you wouldn't charge interest to if you're lending him money. Therefore, you're not allowed to a fellow Yid. Whereas a goy, sure, you have to treat him with derech eretz, and you have to treat him right. But between strangers, no, nobody has any objection to ribis. So therefore, with a goy who's not your brother, he's To that extent, he's considered like a stranger. It's a normal business practice to charge ribis, and therefore you would be allowed to. Although we're going to see later on in the perek that it's actually not so simple to charge goy ribis either. We're going to talk about that. And you have the whole concept nowadays of a heter iska. So the concept of an iska is also discussed in this perek. An iska is basically where you have one person invests money with somebody else and tells him, I'm investing the money. I'm the venture capitalist. You're going to be the managing partner. You're the one who's actually going to be running the business. So there's issues of ribis involved over there because to a certain extent, that money, part of that money is considered like a loan. And therefore, you have rules of how that has to be structured to avoid issues of ribis. So the whole concept of a heter iska is based on that. It's basically that you're taking what would have otherwise been a loan and you're transforming it into a business partnership. So it's complicated and there's the different details that Rishonim and Achronim have put into it to make it that on the one hand, the investor, the lender is more or less certain, is almost 100% certain of getting his money back. And on the other hand, you're not infringing on the minimum of ribis. It's complicated, basically. There was a sicha where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea behind it is when you're charging ribis, in effect, you're saying, look, I'm washing my hands of this. I'm lending you the money. I'm leaving it all up to you. And you got to pay me back with the interest. But I have nothing to do to do with the actual business or with the actual whatever it is that you're running. As opposed to an iska, you're saying, I'm joining with you in a partnership. I have a financial stake in the success of your business, and therefore that better reflects the kind of relationship that we have with Hashem. Hashem doesn't just give us resources and tell us you do on your own and I have nothing to do with it. Just the opposite. Hashem is very, very involved, and therefore by doing a heter iska, by doing it in this way that's mutter, then we recognize that Hashem is deeply involved in the mitzvahs that we do with the resources that he gives / lends us. So the Mishnah starts off. Ezehu neshech ve'ezehu tarbis. Now the pasuk, when it talks about ribis, it talks about it in a number of places. It mentions it in Parshas Mishpatim, Loisa Simun Olav Neshech, we had it in Friday's Kriyas HaTorah. It mentions it again in Parshas Bahar. It mentions it again in Parshas Kisetze. And in some of those places, the Torah uses two expressions, neshech and tarbis, or marbis. So Mishnah starts off, Ezehu Neshech ve'ezehu Tarbis. What is the difference between them? Now, the Gemara is going to end up explaining that even though the Torah uses both terms, the Gemara is going to end up saying that the Chachamim took the word Tarbis and used it and repurposed it to apply to Ribis de Rabbanan. So any case of Ribis min HaTorah is Neshech, and any case of Ribis de Rabbanan is called Tarbis. So what's the difference? Ezehu Neshech, So what's an example of neshech, which is also in HaTorah? Hamalva sela v'chamisha dinarim. A person lends a sela, which contains 4 dinarim, and he says, you have to pay me back 5 dinarim. So that would be plain ribis min HaTorah. So sayim chitin b'sholosh, or he tells him, I'm lending you 2 saw of wheat, and you have to pay me back 3 saw. So those kinds of things, awesome, if neshu neshech, those kinds of things are awesome in HaTorah, because those are examples of neshech. If neshu neshech, rather, because that's biting. The reason why interest is called neshech, Rashi brings on the pasuk, because it's like a snake bite. At first you think it's nothing, and then all of a sudden it blows up into something big. The same way you start out with interest, you think it's a nothing, but over time, as anybody who's had credit card debt knows, for example, over time it blows up into this big thing, and therefore the Torah is saying it's also. So these are examples of neshech, which is also in our Torah. Ve'ezehu tarbis, and what does tarbis mean, which is also only derabanan, is hamarbit pavis. One example, now we're going to have many examples throughout the perek, but the first example is where a person is getting himself a profit using pavis. Meaning, in other words, there's no loan involved, there's a sale involved, and nevertheless, there's still an issue involved. Ketzad, what do we mean by that? Suppose a person buys wheat from somebody else at the rate of a gold dinar per kur. Now, a kur contains 30 saw, and a gold dinar contains 25 silver dinar. So he's paying a little over, so he's paying a little under a dinar per saw. He's paying 25 silver dinar, which is equals 1 gold dinar, for 30 saw of wheat. And that was the price at the time. That was the prevailing price at the time. So now he gave him the money in advance, and he gave him the money in advance. And the deal is that the guy is going to supply him with wheat throughout the season. Now, that kind of thing, we're going to learn throughout the parak. We have a number of exceptions, even though the we're saying midrabanan, there are cases where there's ribis involved over here. There's a among the cases where it's mutter to make a contract in advance like that, it's called yotza hashar, where there's a known prevailing price that lasts at that rate for a certain period of time, then you're allowed to make contracts like that on the payers. Because you are, and because the idea is, Rashi explains, because in principle, the seller would, even if the seller doesn't have the wheat right now, conceivably, he could easily go and buy wheat at that price and give them to the buyer. So therefore, we can consider it even now as though the wheat is already in his possession. And later on, when the price goes up, it's considered as though it appreciated in value in his possession. And therefore, that would be mutter. So far, so good. Later on, later on, this wheat goes up in price and now is worth 30 dinarin. So as opposed to 25 before. So now the buyer says, "Ten lichitai, give me my wheat. I want to sell that wheat at the higher price that's available now of 30 dinarin for the kur, and I want to use that money to buy wine, which right now wine is cheap. So I want to take advantage of that." So if he gives him his wheat, then that was so far so good. That would also be fine. So far, there's no problem of ribis over here, because when he made the contract to begin with, it was yotza hashar. There was a prevailing price at that time, and the fact that later on the price changed, that's fine. He's still allowed to give him the wheat, even though now it's worth more. There's no problem of ribis. But the problem is that now the twist is, the seller says to him, "Listen, you anyway want to buy wine with it?" So Omaloi, the original seller says, instead of giving you the wheat, I'll consider that the wheat is worth 30 now. I owe you 30 dinarim, which is the current price, as if I just bought the wheat from you. And now, instead, for that, you will have now that I'm selling you wine in the value of 30 dinarim, the yayin ain loy, and right now he doesn't have wine. So now there's a problem, because by the time he gives him the wine, the price is going to go up, and therefore it's going to be a problem. Now, on the face of it, you have, what's the problem? You could have yotza hashav, it could be a prevailing price for the wine. What's the problem? The Gemara is going to deal with that later on Daf Samach Beis, Samach Gimel. What exactly is the problem? If there's already yotza hashar on wine, why would that be a problem? But in that case, there we have an example. There's no loan here involved at all. It's strictly buying and selling, and nevertheless, midirabon, and we have a concept of ribis over here. So the Gemara starts off, midishovik l'ribis d'araisa v'kam farish d'rabanan. Given that the Mishnah, now the Mishnah first started saying Ezehu Neshach, Ezehu Tarbis, and almost immediately it goes into, since when it comes to Tarbis, the Mishnah is not defining Tarbis in terms of anything that's also d'araisa. It's defining it only in terms of something d'rabanan. That implies that on a Daraisa level, Neshach and Tarbis mean the same thing. So the Gemara asks, on the face of it, one of the psukim that talks about ribis says you're not allowed to lend him money at Neshach, and you're not allowed to lend him food at Marbis. So doesn't that imply, doesn't that, and it's given us two different lavim, as Kaspacha loy sitin loy b'neshach, or Marbis loy sitin. So doesn't that imply that there are actually two different isurim involved over here? So how can the Mishnah be implying as though there's no such thing as tarbis on a daraisa level, only dirabanan? So the Gemara answers back to Tisra. Well, how could you possibly think anyway that there are two separate things? How could there possibly be neshach without tarbis and tarbis without neshach? Neshach means biting, which again refers to the loss that the other person is having, that he's paying more than what he borrowed. Tarbis is looking at it from the point of view of the malva, that he's gaining more than he gave out in the first place. Inevitably, wherever you have neshach, you have tarbis, and vice versa. So how can you even think that they're two separate things? And because the Gemara explains, neshach b'le tarbis hechidomi, how would you think there could be a possibility of neshach without tarbis? Are you talking about, for example, that he lent him 100 prutas and told him, "You have to pay me back 120? And you could say me'ikra kaimi me'ya b'danka. You could say that to begin with, the prutas were a went at 100 prutas to the ma. All of a sudden, kaimi me'ya v'esra b'danka. Later on, the price of prutas goes still further down, and now 120 of them go into a ma. So you could argue neshech ikka de kanochis leis. You could argue there is neshech. He's biting the other guy. Because he's taking from him something he didn't give him. He gave him only 100 prutas. He's getting back 120. On the other hand, karbis leka. You could argue that there's no karbis involved. The less le ravcha, because he's not really gaining any profit from it. The danka oisvei v'danka kashoko minei, because after all, he lent him a ma and he's getting back a ma. In terms of ma's, he's not getting any more. The ma now is worth more prutas than it was before, but the ma still has the same value and buys the same thing as it would before. So then you could argue that then you have neshach without cannabis. The Gemara says, why? Still, that doesn't really work. So if, no matter how you look at it. If you go according to the original, if you go according to the original value, how much it was worth at the time, well then hare neshach vare tabis, then you have both, because there is neshach. He's paying him 120 prutas instead of 100. And you also have at the time, if you look at how it was originally, that 120 prutas is worth more than a ma, because at the time 100 prutas worth of the ma. And if you go according to the way it is at the end, if you look at how it is at the time of repayment, then there's neither neshech nor tarbis, because after all, he's paying 120 prutas, but the 120 prutas are worth as much as the 100 were at the time. And in terms of a ma, it's also the same. So no matter what, you don't have neshech without tarbis over there. It's either both or neither. Whether in fact you go according to me'ikra, whether you go according to besoif, Hagoyis Hagra mentions that point over here, and mentioned that there's a discussion among Rishonim what in fact we paskin in that regard. When it comes to things like that fluctuate in price or in value, do we end up going according to the original value, or do we go according to the current value? Then there's a discussion of Rishonim about that. What we do in that regard, and whether it would be considered ribis d'araisa, or whether it would be ribis d'rabbanon, which has implications, as we're going to learn in the perek, those implications of the difference, whether it's also d'araisa or d'rabbanon. Rashi, anyway, points out that we're talking about over here 100 or 120 prutas per ma. Tosfos asks that, wait a minute, we usually say that there are 32 prutas to the ma. How over here? Are we talking about 100 or 120? How did the price of a pruta fall so low? So Tosfos brings a couple of possibilities, that it means not 100 prutas to the ma, but 100 prutas to the word danka means 1/6. So instead of 1/6 of a seller, which would be a ma, instead of 1/6 of a dinner, rather, which would be a ma, it could be 1/6 of a mona, which therefore would come out to 4 sloyim and change. Or it could mean 100, not 100 prutas, but 100 isarim, to a sixth of a gold dinner. Either way, the point is you have a proportion over there that approximates 100, and then you can have the price goes a little bit down and ends up at 120. And the Gemara says, but true, furthermore, tarbis b'neshech hechidami. How could you possibly have a case of tarbis without neshech? That you're thinking that they should be considered two different isurim. You're talking about that he lent him 100 prutas on the condition that he's going to lend him 100, that he's going to give him back 100 prutas. So originally 100 prutas were equal to one danka, to one ma, and later on 100 are worth a fifth of a dinar, meaning that the value of prutas has gone up. So there's no neshech because he's not taking any more prutas from him than before, but there is tarbis because the lender is gaining, because before he lent out the equivalent of a ma, and now he's getting the equivalent of more than a ma. So no, again, ibosim ikra azlas. If you go according to the original value, lo neshech ikav lo tarbis ikra, then there's neither neshech nor tarbis because the borrower, the loiva, is not giving out any more than he got. He got 100, he's returning 100. Yes, the 100 are worth more now, but that's you're not actually taking away anything from him that you didn't lend him. And you the malva, are not gaining anything looking at it from the original point of view, because at the time it was worth a ma. So therefore there's no neshech and no tarbis. And if you go according to the end, according to how it is when it's being paid, hare neshech vare tarbis, then you have both neshech and tarbis, because he's having to pay him the equivalent of 1 1/5 ma instead of 1 ma. So anyway, you can never find Neshach without Tavis or Tavis without Neshach when you're talking about only loans. And again, Midaraisa, the whole concept of Ribis is only when it comes to loans. So why are we even thinking, even though the Torah does phrase them as two lavim, why would we even think that they are in fact two separate things and that it's possible to have one without the other? Ela Amar Rava, so Rava says, you're right, Iyata Moitzel HaNeshach Poletavis Poletavis HaNeshach. You're right, it's impossible to find one without the other. When it comes to loans, you're always going to have one and the other. The only reason the Torah divides it up is to say that a person who lends an interest is over on two lavin. So now, Tosfos says, in that case, then the Torah chooses to vary the language to make it nicer, and then to say as kaspa holy sitan loibin neshach or marbis loy sitan ochlecha. Why does the Torah use two words, neshach and marbis? It's just for stylistic purposes to make it sound nicer instead of repeating the same word. But in fact, every time a person would lend at ribis, he's over on both of those lavim, and in addition, he can be over on other lavim, as the Gemara is going to explain toward the end of the parak.